On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 30-plus years after the end of the Vietnam War, Hanoi is the center of the Asia-Pacific economic world for the next week. Leaders from 21 nations, including George W. Bush, will gather for a big economic summit in the land where 50,000 American soldiers died fighting communism. Yesterday, the U.S. Congress gave Vietnam a slap, failing to pass a bill that would rush normalization of U.S. trade relations with the country. But Vietnam is doing just fine anyway, thank you. Per capita income has doubled in 5 years. From Hanoi to Da Nang to Ho Chi Minh City, there's a boom on. Up next on Point, we go to Vietnam 30 years and counting after the war. We will hear in this hour from a Vietnamese-American returned to Hanoi, from a former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, and from a big investor in that country's future. But first, joining me now from Shanghai in China is Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for The New York Times. He's kept a close eye on Vietnam's rise. Keith, great to have you again. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Let's see. Number one, I guess, George Bush is going to arrive in Vietnam with a kind of embarrassment in his pocket instead of normalized trade relations. What happened in Washington yesterday, and how's it being seen from the Asian side?
There is a real nervousness in Washington about approving anything that looks or sounds like a free trade deal these days, particularly after a lot of voters went to the polls last week and voted in favor, some people say, of a more economic populism, of a more, maybe more assertive trade policy, one that pays more attention to protecting manufacturing jobs. Certainly you saw that in the election of Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio. And so the House Republican leadership was surprised when on Monday they failed to get enough votes for a Vietnam trade bill, and then on Tuesday they saw they really weren't likely to get the votes anytime soon. They ended up having to pull the bill off the agenda.
So a little perspective on that. They were looking for a two-thirds vote to rush this through. They may wait and get a simple majority and actually get it in a little bit down the line, but it's not going to be there in President Bush's hand when he arrives.
It won't be. However, this particular bill is almost symbolic. Vietnam has now gotten final approval to join the WTO, and the final paperwork goes through whether the United States Congress likes it or not. The Bush administration was the only one that really had the say on whether or not Vietnam would join the WTO. Now, the vote in Congress, and this is a little complicated, but let me put it simply, the vote in Congress basically does only three things. First of all, it says that the U.S. promises not to put extra restrictions on trade with Vietnam in the future. Well, since the U.S. already doesn't have any special restrictions on trade, it's not clear what difference that would make. Second, if the bill passes, the U.S. would have to lift its quotas on imports of clothing from Vietnam. And third, if the bill passes, then if either the United States or Vietnam doesn't like what the other one does, it can ask a dispute tribunal of the WTO to step in and try to sort things out. But in terms of the basics of trade, like under joining the WTO, Vietnam is going to have to cut its import taxes, which are as high as 100%. You try to buy a bottle of whiskey in Vietnam, it's cost you an arm and a leg because of the 100% tax. That will be cut very quickly, and that will apply to U.S. exports as well. So it's only these three categories of U.S. U.S.-Vietnam trade that are covered by this bill that needs to pass at some point.
And with or without the bill, the United States is already Vietnam's biggest trading partner. We see per capita income doubling in the last 5 years, GDP, the annual growth, 7%. What's the Vietnamese economy look like, Keith? What's it booming on? Is it a sort of a lagging carbon copy of China 10 years ago? What's at the heart of it?
It increasingly looks like a lagging carbon copy of China. That's a good way to put it. I've been to Vietnam twice in the past month, but I also travel a lot in China. I just arrived in Shanghai tonight. And a lot of it feels like maybe an inland province of China. Often the inland provinces of China are 10 years behind the coastal provinces. The Vietnamese are investing very heavily in building new four-lane highways everywhere. You're seeing a lot of factories going up. They're still producing the kind of things that China dominated 10 years ago, but as China starts moving up the ladder towards more sophisticated goods like cars and steel and so forth, some of these industries are moving to Vietnam. Now, what are the examples of that? You've got shoes going to Vietnam, shoe production going to Vietnam in a big way, a lot of garments. It tends to be the cheaper garments like T-shirts and so forth, mm-hmm. whereas China's now moving into sort of some of the fancier
fashion.
Women's
mm-hmm.
dresses and mm-hmm. fashion items and so forth. All the big French and Italian fashion houses, in fact, now have operations in, or at least buy some of their clothes from China. But what you're seeing is sort of the base of industrialization in Vietnam taking place very quickly.
And what about on the political side, Keith? What does that look like now? The communists won the Vietnam War. They still rule. Is that like China? Is it this kind of loose but determined central authority? What's the political profile?
It is a lot like China as well, in the sense that you still have a tightly controlled state in which people have received, for example, long jail sentences for giving Bibles to government officials. Mm. There's still been some wariness of organized religion. On the other hand, there are some areas in which Vietnam has gone farther than China. And the two I would mention is, one, Vietnam has reached an agreement with the Vatican on the selection of bishops and has eased up more than China in terms of its repression of the Catholic Church. Second, Vietnam allowed at least the what seemed like an open discussion of who would become the next prime minister in the National Assembly. Now, there may not have been that much doubt, but the process of at least choosing the prime minister in Vietnam was a little more open than the process has been in China. And in fact, the way the Vietnamese went about it attracted a lot of attention in China over the last few months, that the Vietnamese Communist Party, despite having been in some ways more repressive than the Chinese Party 5 and 10 years ago, now seems to be moving a little more quickly to at least allowing more people within the Communist Party a say in the leadership.
And Keith, finally, let me ask you, President Bush is on his way. He's got a big trip starting in Moscow, but then heading down through Asia. Is there a kind of, contest of influence at this big economic summit meeting between the United States and now China, though the meeting is in Hanoi?
There is. What's interesting is that the Vietnamese really want the closer relations with the United States as a balance to Chinese influence. China and Vietnam fought a border war, after all, 3 years after the Vietnam War. Vietnam sees this incredibly powerful, increasingly prosperous, militarily strong China right on its border. And as a result, it has been nervously looking out for investment from other places, and for political ties. They actively court Taiwanese investment, mm. which makes the Chinese mad. But both Taiwan and Vietnam view each other as balancing their very large neighbor nearby.
Mm. Keith Bradshaw, thanks for getting us situated here. Thanks for joining us today from Shanghai.
Thank you.
Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong Bureau Chief of The New York Times. Joining me now from the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, is Nguyen Ky Duc, former host of the public radio show Pacific Time, which covers Asia and Asian American issues. His book, Where the Ashes Are, is a memoir of growing up in Vietnam and America. He was 9 years old during the Tet Offensive in 1968 when the Viet Cong captured his father, a high-ranking civil servant. Duc fled Saigon in 1975 with his uncle's family, and they resettled in America. He's just returned to Vietnam as senior editor for Pacific Time in Asia. Nguyen Ky Duc, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. Thank you very much for having me.
I know you've paid a lot of attention to Vietnam for a long time. Now you're back there. Just paint a word picture of Hanoi for us to begin. What does this gracious old French colonial city look like in a boom time in Vietnam?
Well, some parts of it remains that gracious part, which is so lovely, and the trees are still there, and the old homes are still there. But if you go towards the outskirts, you start to see all these high-rises and all the cinder blocks going up everywhere. People are richer now. There are a lot more cars, and the signs of wealth is certainly on the surface, on the streets. They're spanking new hospitals and that sort of thing happening everywhere, and the latest models of cars, for example.
And the people you talk to, the Vietnamese, do they feel in your conversations, our time has finally come, we're on our way, the boom is blossoming?
I, in fact, talked to a number of young students from universities, the School for International Relations, School for Foreign Languages, and they are very excited about this chance. Some of them consider this the second biggest event with APEC and this boom and this attention on Vietnam as the second biggest event since the end of the war. And this country is now full of people who weren't even born when the war ended. Very excited.
We've been joined from Hanoi, capital of Vietnam, by Nguyen Ky Duc. He's former host, now senior editor for Asia of the public radio show Pacific Time. It's broadcast out of member station KQED in San Francisco. Also with us right now from San Francisco, Henry Nguyen. He's managing general partner IDG Ventures Vietnam, the first and largest venture capital firm fund in Vietnam, investing there in telecom and media and technology companies. Henry Nguyen, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You spent a lot of time in Vietnam. You're putting some big money down there. What do you see coming in this country?
Well, there's a lot of changes. As Duc had said, you know, you can actually feel it and see it in the street. It's very palpable. And I think anybody who has come to visit Vietnam, from the moment you sort of step out of the airport, you can really see the changes occurring. And it's, like I said, a palpable feeling on the street.
So you've got $100 million or something like that you're ready to put into Vietnam, or you've begun to already. Where are you investing? What do you see coming?
Well, we're trying to apply the venture capital model that's, you know, done in Boston and done in Silicon Valley and bring it to Vietnam in terms of investing in technology, media, and telecom in Vietnam. And it's interesting that Keith mentioned that Vietnam in many ways is sort of China minus 8 to 10 years, because that's really, from what we see, there's a lot of similarities between the two markets, and we're using our own experience from investing in China and bringing that model to Vietnam.
Nguyen Ky Duc, there in Hanoi, in what was years ago North Vietnam, is there still a sharp distinction between North and South? Do you have a feeling that I'm in the North now, I'm in the South now, or has the country blended into one culture, one economy in the years since the war?
I think economically it's beginning to integrate a lot more. I think culturally you will see the differences if you travel around. In terms of, if you get to know the people, you know this cultural difference has existed way before the war existed. People are very different in some ways. And yet if you're talking about a strong desire to join the world, then there's no difference between the North and the South. I think the South has produced some very good managers. Some people are very practical. And some of those are now in the leadership ranks. This year is the first time where all three top leaders, other than the party chief, has come from the South.
So the South making its mark in the political realm as well. Henry Nguyen, American companies making a mark. Intel Corp. Announcing very recently it will triple its opening investment in Vietnam to $1 billion, putting up a big chip assembly and testing plant there. What draws a company like Intel to Vietnam? Is it just cheap labor, low wages?
Well, that's definitely the principal part in the beginning. You know, this is still an early investment for Intel, and it's really lower on the value chain in terms of chip and semiconductor manufacturing. But it's not just cheap labor. I think Intel also sees a long-term potential that, as Duc mentioned, the country is very, very young. So you have an up-and-coming country, not only economically, but demographically. 70% of people are under the age of 35, and more than half are under the age of 25. So you basically have more than two-thirds of the people born after the war. So, you know, it's a very hardworking labor force, very, very sort of well-skilled, although there will be a lot of training Intel will have to do. But the literacy rate is very high. It's 94%. And I think what Intel sees is a long-term potential of not only taking advantage of sort of low-cost labor and other sort of incentives that the government has given, but really a longer view of really training and taking some of the sort of potential talent there and developing into sort of higher value-added parts of the semiconductor manufacturing chain.
Both of your families left Vietnam in 1975 in the midst of the tremendous turmoil there. Now you've both spent a lot of time there again. Henry, I know you've been back a lot with your father, in fact, who was in the South Vietnamese government. I think you and he set up a telecoms company. Nhung Ki Duc, you're there right now and have been there a lot. First to you, Nhung Ki Duc in Hanoi. How does it feel coming back after all the history that Americans and you know so well? What's the sensation as a Vietnamese American being back in Vietnam? Is it welcoming? Is it bittersweet? Is it now rosy?
It's bittersweet at times, but you know, we Vietnamese tend to want to look at history in very long term. I mean, the war with America perhaps lasted 25, 30 years, but Hanoi has been the capital for 1,000 years. And so culturally, it's very exciting to be here now. And I've had very warm reception. There are some questions, certainly around the issue of security of APEC and what sort of image journalists would want to portray in the world of Vietnam. And so there are some concerns there. But other than that, I feel quite welcome.
Henry Nguyen, how about you? You were just, maybe 2 years old when you left, in a few days before Saigon, then Saigon, fell to the communists, April 1975. Now you're back. How does it feel to you and your father? And how do the Vietnamese seem to see you as a Vietnamese-American, brother or something foreign?
Now, it's pretty interesting because, you know, I left at a very early age. Frankly, mm-hmm. I had no memories of Vietnam growing up in the U.S. So returning was in many ways coming to a totally foreign place I wasn't connected to. But frankly, kind of coming back, you feel a connection. It's hard to describe exactly what it is, but it feels like home. Maybe it's just the food and the language, but there's something deeper for sure that I felt coming back that I was quite surprised at, because in many ways, I grew up very, very American, just like any other sort of American kid. You know, that was my life, and coming back to Vietnam was never something that was in my sort of consideration set as I sort of got out of school and started my career. So it was very surprising to feel that, but I think, as Duc said, I think Vietnamese in general still, and I think it's from my parents, hold on to a very strong sense of culture and identity in that sense, and I didn't really fully realize that till I came back.
And how do they see or treat you as something exotic, something foreign, or, you know, welcome home, Henry Nguyen?
I think it's a mix of all those things. What happened in the beginning was for sure that I used to get the question, and this is a little bit of a joke, but it was true. I used to get the question of where are you from? And for me, I always wanted to say an answer. I'm from Vietnam because I was born in Vietnam and my parents were Vietnam. But they would be persistent. So, no, really, where are you from? And,
right.
And of course, I'd answer the U.S. And actually, it was greeted with a lot of interest and curiosity. I would say... It was a very, very rare thing to ever sense any sort of animosity or bad feeling. But I guess as you live there more, you integrate more. And I've been there now more than 5 years, and you learn the language. But, my Vietnamese is not perfect yet. In fact, what's funny is that there's a real regional accent difference between the North and the South. So when I'm in Hanoi these days, most people think I'm from Saigon, and vice versa. When I'm in Saigon, most people think I'm from Hanoi. So I joke, or my friends joke, that may not be better than being from abroad when you're in those two cities.
Right. Nhung Ki Duc, you're in Hanoi. I wonder about attitudes there toward Americans. It was a long and bitter war. I remember being in Hanoi some years ago now. I guess it would have been in the mid-80s, and just sitting down to dinner with a stranger, striking up a conversation, we began to talk about our families. This was a North Vietnamese man. He said to me very pointedly at one point, we were talking about our children. He said, I had one son at that time, so did he. He said, my son's name is Victory. What's yours? And that question hung over that table. What about Vietnamese attitudes toward the United States today?
No, I've been back here since 1989, some 25 times or so over the years. I've come back quite a lot. And yes, there's some sort of suspicious attitude among the older people, but they're very far and few in between. Generally, they think of America as a kind nation, as an advanced nation. They don't quite understand government policies overseas. They don't understand the sort of meddling in Iraq and in other parts of the world. But generally, they feel very good about the tourists. Obviously, there's an economic question there where tourists come and are helpful in the businesses and there's that. But generally, the Vietnamese are very open people. As long as you come with a friendly attitude, they're absolutely friendly to you, and they will help out. They will joke around with you. They want to learn English. They want to practice whatever English they have. They're not too shy. It was amazing to me that within an hour of arriving here at my house here that I'd rented here, the people in the neighborhood sort of came around, talked to me. Imagine yourself being in the South, for example, the kind of friendliness in the South in the U.S., mm-hmm. where people would bring food over, they'd come ask about my mother. I brought my 82-year-old mother, and every afternoon I take her out to the lake here, and we take a quick walk, and people come and chat. And they know I come from the South, had left right after the war. They found all these stories. I mean, they ask questions. But there's no question. They don't even question why I didn't go back to the South or why did I come to Hanoi. But they're there, and they're very helpful. If I push my bike out, they come to help. You know, they clear out of the way, all of that sort of stuff. They are very curious about Americans and Vietnamese Americans. But they're fairly friendly, and with the internet, with the kind of information that they're getting now, films and whatever, they do get a sense of America that they like.
So open arms and hospitality for you there, but a lot of history too, and now this rising economic profile of Vietnam. Nguyen Ky Duc in Hanoi, Henry Nguyen in San Francisco, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Tony's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that the main reason that companies are moving to Vietnam, and we even have a situation when companies are moving from China to Vietnam, is because Vietnam wages are one-third the level of China, and there's no unions, and it's there's a extreme exploitation of workers, which to me is very upsetting because I fought myself. I fought very hard against the Vietnam War when I was young, and I visited Hanoi during the time of U.S. bombing and feel a lot of solidarity with Vietnam, but it's very upsetting to see the way they're exploiting workers now.
Do you see this as a first necessary step on a rough ladder of rising in the free market or straight-up exploitation, the word you used?
I see it as part of the race to the bottom that's going on all over the world. We used to see in Central America, I was a journalist before, now I work with think tanks that study economies all over the world, on the Global Policy Network. But in Central America, there used to be textile mills before they moved to Asia. And when one country would set its wages 10 cents an hour lower, these textile mills would get up and move to the other country. And that race to the bottom has been going on for the last 20 years, and Vietnam is just the latest place in that.
And if those wages are a third of China's, that's pretty attractive. Tony, thanks for that call. To respond, I want to turn to Honolulu, Hawaii, and Ambassador Raymond Burkhart. He served as U.S. ambassador to Vietnam from 2001 to 2004. He joins us from Honolulu. Ambassador Burkhart, thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, glad to join you. Glad to be with my friend Henry, and also Duc, who I don't think I have met.
It's great to have you. And we hear the kind of optimism and promise in Vietnam's economic stirring, more than stirring now, booming in some part, and yet it's still a one-party state. And you hear our caller, Tony, in Washington saying, here's another example of exploited workers. Let's be careful what we celebrate. There's a kind of moral cost politically and maybe economically as well. You were our ambassador there. How do you see those issues?
Well, I agree with comments of some of your other people who have been on, Henry and others, about the tremendous energy in Vietnam. The country is growing fast. I think when you see American companies going in there, and I saw a lot go in while I was there and got to know a lot of the American investors well, going for low wages is not entirely what it's all about. I remember my friends at Nike, for example, telling me that what excited them about investing in Vietnam was that were two things. One was that after something like 6 years, they had a higher productivity level from the workers in Vietnam than they had in Thailand after only 2 years.
So a hardworking populace, okay, but still those low wages have to be attractive.
You have, Vietnam culturally has a lot of similarities with China, mm-hmm. and in many ways very distinct from the rest of Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
You have that Confucian influence, which makes education very highly prized, makes people hardworking. I was just in Vietnam last week at a seminar attended by a large number of people about developing entrepreneurship in Vietnam. The concept is understood there, whereas perhaps it's not so well understood in other places in Southeast Asia. So, the other thing attracted Nike and a lot of other companies, which have suffered from sort of bad reputation for labor relations in previous years, is that in Vietnam they were able to implement some rather strict standards. And there are a number of organizations, including organizations backed by the AFL-CIO, backed by the International Labor Organization. Some of them received U.S. government funding. Some receive international funding.
Watching labor practices there.
Yeah, working hard to ensure respectable labor practices.
But let me ask you, if I may, Ambassador. I mean, does it give you pause? Should it give us pause? We wish Vietnam well. Why not? But it's a one-party authoritarian state. 50,000 American soldiers died fighting there. Do you just applaud and say, well, okay, dissent not allowed, one-party state, yes, it's authoritarian, but they've got a hard-working workforce and high productivity and low wages, so let's go.
I was in Vietnam during the war for 2.5 years, and I certainly didn't want the war to turn out the way it did, but it's been a long time. And I also I also visited Vietnam in the early 80s, and I saw how repressive things were at that time. I also saw China in the 70s, and I've seen the change that's taken place in China over the last 30 years. Yes, it is a one-party state. It's one of the world's last five communist countries. Some of us call it market Leninism. They've thrown out the Marx, but they've kept the Lenin, which means if you publicly advocate a multi-party system, you will end up in jail in Vietnam, as is true in China as well.
Jimmy's calling from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Jimmy?
Well, you know, I'm a government contractor here on Fort Bragg, and it's bad that the American people, the way that jobs are now, and the Americans, I feel like, are doing it to themselves because, you know, basically, if you go shopping, every store that you go in, 95% of everything that you buy is imported. The only real things in America that you can actually buy that's actually made in America is maybe a toothpick. And what's sad is overseas, these cars like your Chevrolets and Fords, you know, they're struggling on sales because the American people are buying so much foreign stuff.
So what do you say, Jimmy? Should we put the tariff walls up and become protectionists and say no thank you to shoes from Vietnam?
Exactly. And what's bad is you got these high-dollar celebrities that are endorsing and making millions off of poor people, really. You know, and it's bad. And, you know, every soldier that I've worked around and talked to, that's like the war in Iraq. Every soldier that I've talked to basically supports this war. And our country is so divided because the liberals, the Democrats, and the conservatives, I mean, we're divided. And other countries look at us and basically laugh. And it's sad.
And off go the jobs. Jimmy, let us pick that up. And Henry Nguyen, let me come to you with that. There you are with a pot of dollars to invest in Vietnam. And you hear Jimmy and Fort Bragg saying, wait a minute. American jobs just go overseas. We need the manufacturing here. You saw Congress yesterday not rushing to normalize these trade relations formally. How do you respond to Jimmy's complaint, his concern, Henry?
Well, I think, you know, we can't deny that we live in a very globalized economy now. Then there's a lot of interconnectedness between our economy and obviously the rest of the world.
But he's saying, wait a minute, let's slow up. Even let's put up some walls here and protect American jobs. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the consequences are going to be that, you know, the American consumer today enjoys an incredible amount of, I'll say, purchasing power, not because of just their income, but because of the lower cost of goods that are sourced all over the world. In many ways, I guess, is the controversy of, well, we're turning the sort of world into our Walmart in terms of finding low-cost producers everywhere and sort of large homogenized superstores. But, you know, maybe this is the trend today in terms of how sort of the American consumer sort of gets goods. But, you know, I think this is not just a phenomenon that's being driven from overseas. It's also being driven by the American consumer in terms of its demands of lower costs for many things. And I think that's where then manufacturers and suppliers, et cetera, are having to look for lower cost sources of labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeon Ki-duk, there in Hanoi, how do you feel about it? Textile plants will go there and have other factories and jobs will go there and have. Do you see that primarily as good news for the Vietnamese people? Do you see it as bad news for the American worker or not?
I think it is in some ways, as Tom said, it is bad news for workers, but it is the system that is being set up that way with America in the very beginning. It is certainly good news for a large number of Vietnamese. I wanted to go back to one thing, though, in terms of the labor in Vietnam. The Vietnamese are beginning to form unions or at least some unofficial groupings to demand better wages and equalize that. The Vietnamese entry into WTO, the Vietnamese have had to go through all kinds of promises of reforms in order to play as an equal partner in the globalized world. And it will take some adjustment to get all of that in line. But, you know, I certainly would like to have sympathy for the workers in America. But I think that would be a problem that would be solved in America, not in Vietnam.
Ambassador Burkhardt, I'm sure you've had to answer this kind of question, challenge before. Now here's President Bush. After the election, Congress not acting on these normalized trade relations, having to show up in Vietnam with empty pockets when he expected to have this agreement in hand. Do you see a change in the wind, or is the migration of jobs to this kind of labor pool inevitable?
Of course, the agreement actually got a majority of support, and I expect it probably will pass shortly when it's put to a vote under different procedures.
Mm-hmm.
I would emphasize to your callers that remember that there's a lot of work that goes on by American embassies every day overseas in promoting American products and promoting access for American companies. When I was in Vietnam, a lot of the day of my staff was taken up selling Boeing planes, overcoming the competition from Airbus. It was selling GE engines for those planes, making sure they didn't buy Rolls-Royce engines.
And bless you for that work, but we can all read the trade figures, and we know where the red ink is. It's on the American side.
Yeah, but the sales are being made for the products that we can make at competitive prices. That includes turbines for power plants, and it includes access for American service industries, which doesn't necessarily result in a balance in terms of manufactured products, but helps to bring dollars back to the United States from American banks, American insurance companies, the sale of American movies. Those are the kind of products in which we can do well, we can compete well, and we have to keep working to make sure that we have access to the market. And if we don't... If we put up barriers against other countries, they will retaliate with barriers against us. And in fact, the people who will benefit will be the Europeans who don't have the barriers.
So it hurts when your job goes abroad, but if you're making money in Vietnam, if you're Boeing or GE or Henry Nguyen, I'm sure the companies you intend to invest in, there's opportunity there. Cuts both ways. Let's take a call from West Hartford, Connecticut. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm enjoying the show. I'd like to ask your guest who had mentioned that China and Vietnam have a system now that might be called Marxist-Leninism. I was curious about that. What did they get from Lenin as opposed to the economics? Would that be totalitarianism or authoritarianism? And I'd also like to know how Marxist-Leninism would differ from fascism.
Ambassador Burkhardt, there's a pointed question for your throwaway line. What do you say?
It's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. When I talk about Leninism, I think, like most political scientists, I'm talking about a system in which of one-party rule, a political system in which the party controls all organizations, the kind of system they have in Vietnam in which private organizations, what's called a civil society, is only reluctantly allowed. That's what Leninism. What we mean when we talk about Leninism, it's breaking down because as you get a large private sector in Vietnam, I mean most people now don't work for the government. As you get a large private sector, it becomes more and more difficult for the government to maintain that kind of control over people's lives.
But breaking down fast enough for Americans to wholeheartedly welcome Vietnam's rise, or is it possible we'll see an economic powerhouse, another economic powerhouse, without the kind of political rights that Americans very much hoped historically would proliferate around the world? Ambassador? I mean, are we going to end up here with a trading partner and a thriving economy that we can also admire politically, or are we just fueling authoritarianism?
We have a lot of trading partners around the world and a lot of countries we deal with which don't have political systems that would be ideal from our point of view. A lot of countries deal with us and maybe don't think we're ideal from their point of view. We're in a world in which we all work with each other and live with each other, and we have arguments with each other. We disagree on things. I had lots of fights with the Vietnamese about human rights and religious freedom issues, but we still can gain from each other and still can work with each other.
Steve, thanks for your call. Let's go to Mark in Norwell, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
This is a really fascinating discussion because, especially to me, it seems that the war in Iraq is actually the last chapter of the Vietnam era.
What do you mean by that, Mark?
Well, I think that the war in Iraq is actually a reaction of Paul Wolfowitz and Cheney, Rumsfeld, and then Bush to what happened after Vietnam. In really a direct reactionary result of it. But, you know, that aside, what's happening in Vietnam, I think that China and Vietnam both are doing the opposite of what Russia did. Russia did glasnost first and then perestroika, and China and Vietnam are doing perestroika, and then I think glasnost will come in.
And what does that all mean to you, that we should just patiently wait while their economic growth encourages more open societies? No need to go to war? Is that your view? Just wait?
Actually, yes. No need to go to war, I think, is the main point. And probably, there's two lessons from Vietnam that everybody talks about. One is we shouldn't have gone there. One is that we should have gone with overwhelming force.
Mm-hmm.
They're really the opposite lessons. The real lesson in the way that the world has gone in the last half a century is that, you know, human nature tends towards freedom, whether you fight for it or you just let a country do what it wants. And that's what's happening, what's been happening all over the world, Central America, the Soviet Union, what's happening in China.
Let the sun shine and wait, maybe. Mark, let us pick that up. Nguyen Ky Duc, I want to bring that to you in Hanoi. Your father spent 12 years in prison after the Tet Offensive. He was captured by the Viet Cong. That's a long time. So how do you feel about freedom and Vietnam, the level of openness there now, and looking back on the war, a mistake? Should the United States just have waited and let nature take its course?
Well, you know, I mean, 12 years, as you say, is a long time, but the history of all of this is a longer time. One thing I do want to mention is that the Vietnamese here and Americans who've been working here over the past few years that I know here, and I keep returning to talk to them, have seen a lot of these changes in the past, say, since 85, 86. A lot of the changes where personal freedoms are a lot more accessible, and that people are freer to do things. There are measures being put into place by the government where the media can criticize up to the ranks of the minister, exposing cases of corruption. There are signs here and there. There are also signs of people being put in prison and where they call for a multi-party system. Yet the debate is there, the recognition that some of these freedoms need to happen for Vietnam aid to integrate into the world economies and to integrate into the world, and at the same time to have a strong people that can progress, for the nation to progress. So there are the good signs as well as the bad signs over the short amount of time, really, since the end of the war. And people have put away the war in order to rebuild the country. They're not as obsessed with the Vietnam War, as you call it, as we are in America.
I want to pick up another caller on this theme from Wallingford, Connecticut. Gil is on the line. Hi, Gil, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Just as a quick comment, and I'd like to hear your guest reaction. I'm a Hispanic American, mm-hmm. and it's very disconcerting to hear this country forming political and economic alliances with one-party governments that we have been at war with, albeit many years ago, and yet we have a country 90 miles off our borders that we have no relations with.
You're talking Cuba. So, Gil, are you saying shut down relations with these countries and let them suffer,
or open
up with both of them?
I'm not saying shut down relations with them. The relationships, I think, in the long run, probably are beneficial. I think we should also explore relationships with Cuba, that if we don't, we will just be shooting ourselves in the foot by ignoring a neighbor right off our coast who we have not had a war with, who has had one of the most peaceful revolutions in the history of this hemisphere. And so it's just a comment that it's very disconcerting, and to some reason I would use the word hypocrisy in terms of where we're going as a nation.
Gil, we've got it. We appreciate your call. I mean, we've got the news just in the last week. We had some Americans sentenced to prison, not for long, but nevertheless, in Vietnam for trying to promote dissent there. Henry Nguyen, what about the Vietnam-Cuba comparison? If we're open to Vietnam, should we be trading and investing with Cuba as well?
Well, it's kind of funny that the caller also brought up Cuba, because for many years, you know, Vietnam and Cuba were, if you will, the lone countries holding out and holding on to sort of more hardline communist doctrine.
But now President Bush is on his way to Vietnam and not to Havana.
Right. I think that may have to do a little bit about some personal politics when you're talking about Castro. But I think the other side is that Vietnam, from 86 onward, when they had their sort of Doi Mui sort of reforms, that it wanted and started this track that it's, you know, where it's at today, more than two decades ago, of being a much more sort of globally integrated economy that can participate with the rest of the world. And I think it learned lessons that being in isolation benefited no one, not its people, and definitely not many of its political relationships. And I think hand in hand, what has happened over the past decade, you know, in terms of the economic relationship the U.S. has had in Vietnam, has been a tremendous catalyst. And Ambassador Burghardt can relate to this more than I directly. But in terms of our political relationships, that I would say the leadership in Vietnam really does want to have much tighter economic and political relationships with the U.S. as a counterbalance to the relationship with China. And it's a very interesting triangular relationship that, again, is something that for us as Americans, we need to pay attention to quite specifically.
And we're doing that right now. A lot of history, a lot of complexity, a fascinating discussion. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Henry Nguyen at IDG Ventures Vietnam in San Francisco, thanks for joining us. Nguyen Ky Duc in Hanoi with Pacific Time, thanks for being here. And Ambassador Raymond Burghardt, thank you very much for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.